From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
How closely do you monitor what your child looks at online? A lot of parents look at screen time on a device as a way to keep the kids quiet for a few hours so they can get some work done or maybe have a cheeky Chardonnay and binge watch something on Netflix. But a new survey suggests parents should be paying closer attention to what their kids are doing. A survey of more than 16,000 WA school children, the biggest of its kind, found nearly half of high school students were in regular contact online with strangers. Arguably even worse, 30% of primary school children, including some as young as 9, were talking to strangers online at least once a month. Don't know about you guys, but the thought of my child messaging a stranger on the internet is legit terrifying. But it gets even worse. The survey also revealed a spike in children being sent unwanted sexual material. It found more than half female students said they'd received unwanted sexual material via their phones. And I reckon in the vast majority of those cases, it's been sent by young boys. If this is what our boys are doing, no wonder we have men like Tim Payne. But it's not just talking to strangers or sexual content that's a problem for our kids. There's also the impact social media is having on body image. And the survey found nearly a third of female high school students were worried a lot about their weight. Throw in cyberbullying, which is a growing problem for our young people, and you've got a lot to worry about as a parent. So what should you do? Well, for starters, don't just let them sit in front of a screen and think it's a harmless way for you to get some me time. Start a conversation with your kids. You don't need to lecture them, but just have a chat about what their concerns are and maybe raise some of the issues that I've already mentioned. Because a lot of WA kids are going through this stuff and there's a good chance your kids are too. Coming up on the show, Police Minister Paul Papalia has a message for bikies. Plus, we'll talk to a protester who's chained herself to a concrete barrel to stop a new gas project. And what are WA mining companies doing as the vaccine deadline looms? But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now in the studio is Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate. Happy hump day.
Happy hump day. And now, just for the listeners at home, you've walked into the studio in an all-white ensemble. Initially, I thought, is there a game of cricket on today that Matt Tinney's got to go and play?
I've got to rush off. Or is he off to the Mediterranean?
He's off to the Mediterranean. So, can you give us an explanation of what's going on here?
So, I'm hosting the Pride Parade with Monique Dirks from 7
Wonderful.
News on the weekend. Yeah, looking forward to that on
Belmont?
Saturday
this
night.
Is the one at Belmont
Gloucester
Race
Park, is that right?
Gloucester Park?
Oh, God. Oh, God, I should know where it is, shouldn't
Where's
I?
It, Gloucester? It is Gloucester, isn't it? Yeah. I thought it was Belmont. Yeah, Gloucester
goodness.
Park. Oh, yeah, lovely.
Well, it's hard. We've got so many racetracks. So, I'm halfway through trying on clothes because this is how it works when you host events. Like our stylist, Bridget, who's lovely, will go and source things. And we ordered stuff and hoped it would arrive in time. And it has arrived in time. So now it's a bit of a fashion parade going on downstairs to work out what works with what.
And can you give us a bit of a tease of what the outfit might be?
So I haven't got it with me. As you know, right now I do have the white jeans on. Now I'm hoping not to drop anything
quite
on myself.
Quite tight, jeans. I have to
well,
say.
Well, I've been working
Don't
out.
Don't leave much.
Been
to
working
the
out at the gym. Do you need me to turn around the other way? Or
and so, because this is a pride parade, will there be parts of those jeans cut out?
No, there's going to be no cut out. I might have a bit of exposed ankle.
Oh, yeah.
But I've got a hot pink jacket.
Nice.
I look like I've walked out of the 80s.
Yeah, okay.
Pretty much.
All right, nice.
If that's the visual.
Oh, good. Oh, that's going to be exciting.
And it's going to be big.
You'll stand out, a bit like the protesters up in the Burra Peninsula who chained themselves to concrete barrels.
Yes. How's this? So, protesters moved in overnight at the entrance to Woodside's LNG plant up there, the Pluto plant, and they have kind of changed themselves to this barrel of concrete sitting inside a caravan, and the barrel is, we're told, attached to the chassis of the caravan, and then we have a car towing the caravan with somebody under the car and chained in there. So they've created a blockade situation. People can't get in for morning shift. People can't get out. Woodside's supplying their workers with food at the moment. Police have moved in, but they're going to have to get get specialist resources from Perth flown up there to remove these protesters, because the protesters say, look, if you just tow the caravan, you're going to break our arms.
Yeah, and crush the guys underneath.
Underneath the car. So this is a nightmare for Woodside. It's all because of these protesters fighting against Woodside's Scarborough gas plant development. And we know that what's happened is Woodside have gotten to the point where they've given their final investment decision. You know, it's progressing from their viewpoint. The protesters say they've tried everything. They've tried petitions, they've tried marches, and so now they've had to, you know, I suppose, go to activism to highlight this issue.
Yeah, well, we're going to try and get one of the protesters on the line a bit later on in the show. And it's, that area is no stranger to protests. Like the Burrup Peninsula saw protests under the Barnett government, which was successful at Price Point. A few years ago. It's hard to see them stopping this one, a multi-billion dollar gas project that's already been approved by everybody.
And it's gone through environmental approvals, et cetera. So Woodside's been at pains to, you know, explain that. They have issued a statement saying, look, we respect the right of people to protest, but this is going too far.
Mm, yeah, you'd be pretty dark if you were the workers trying to go the other way who'd knocked off and you're trying to get home after 12 hours.
Be like
shift.
Me, just with like toothpicks keeping your eyes open.
Yeah, exactly. They need you and your white jeans up there to keep
them awake.
Who needs
high vis?
Yeah. It's highly visible, that's for sure. And now let's talk about these anti-vaxxers who, of all of the things that they've threatened the Premier with, I think this is the most extreme, the most disgusting.
This is like some sort of ISIS-inspired threat. So they've threatened, allegedly, to behead the Premier and his children.
I mean, have no words.
No words. So these two young men, how's this, have gotten bail. They're out on bail this morning.
It's obviously because the judges thought, you know what, these are just two idiots.
Yeah.
Like, they're not, the only thing they're a danger to is probably themselves.
And this is the thing, the Premier's phone number was published, they've left a message on the voicemail, boom.
Yeah, and what were they inspired by? You know, history? Was this a sort of a French Revolution? to be honest with you, I don't think either of these clowns could even spell guillotine.
Oh, well, I mean,
I'm not sure I can.
I can understand there are a lot of people out there who are frustrated that, you know, the border's not open. You know, some people are frustrated about vaccine mandates, all these sorts of issues. But really, I mean, threatening the Premier, who's just doing his job, you know, and let's face it, has probably worked harder than these two guys the past couple of years.
And has saved how many lives from COVID, when we've seen deaths everywhere else around even Australia, let alone the world.
You know, I think it comes back to play the ball, not the man.
Yeah. Just absolutely ridiculous. And I just don't get these people who say, you know, don't tell us what to do with our bodies, but then they're threatening to behead somebody. That's much worse than getting a vaccine.
Yeah. It's
jeez.
A little bit past a jab, isn't it?
And talking about getting the jab, the mining companies having to deal with that. We're going to talk to our mining reporter Stu McKinnon about this a bit later on the show. But the deadline for FIFO workers to get the jab is looming.
1 week to go. So mining companies are already preparing to fly home unjabbed workers. We're being told that those who are not vaccinated aren't even being sent away for their swings now. So we're that close.
Yeah. Wow.
In terms of what happens to them, the companies have been pretty vague. You know, we've seen, say, for example, WA Police saying if you're not vaccinated, then, you know, your pay is going to get stopped and you're going to be, you know, stood down. The mining companies have been a little bit vague about it. Maybe they're in desperate need of people. But they say they will deal with each unvaccinated worker on a case-by-case basis in terms of their future employment and their role.
Mm, yeah. Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how this unfolds. And then what are the latest vax figures?
So we have number of first doses, 1,877,000 odd. In terms of double vaccinated, we're at 1.6 million now. So we've passed that little milestone at 72.9%. 72.4, so back to the up 0.5.
Yeah, we had a bit of a bigger jump yesterday.
We had a 1% jump, which tends to happen early in the week. I'm noticing this pattern.
Yeah, but I guess people, it's like on Monday, they're just like, oh, let's go and get it done.
Yeah, or, you know, maybe someone hasn't filled out all the documentation over the weekend and someone pressed return and then it uploads.
Yeah, that's probably more likely.
Yeah.
All right, so 72.9.
We've got to get to 90.
When do you reckon we'll get to 75? End of next week?
72.9, 72, yeah, maybe end of next week, maybe, if we have a push early next week. Yeah,
all right, okay.
Have we got a super vax weekend coming up? That was successful.
We better get it done, because the thing is, the weekends, I'm sure, are going to get worse and worse for vaccination, because it's getting time where people are doing Christmas shopping.
Maybe they just need an ad campaign, like, get vaccinated or you will die, the border's opening.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Maddie, thanks as always. I'll let you take your white jeans back to your fashion
I'm
parade.
I'm having to avoid everyone so nobody spills anything on me on the way back down.
I hope you make
it. Can you imagine trying to get the stains out of this? Oh,
I know. It'd be a nightmare.
It'd be the nappy sand challenge. That's what it'd be.
We'll talk to you on the show tomorrow.
We'll do. Have a good one, mate.
You're listening to The West Live.
The brazen assassination of bikie boss Nick Martin at the Kwinana Motorplex last year shocked WA, and it sparked an escalation of drive-by shootings in the criminal underworld. Well, legislation will hit Parliament today that is set to give WA police sweeping new powers in their crackdown of outlaw bikie gangs. Joining me now to explain it all is Police Minister Paul Papalia. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, mate. How are you going?
Yeah, good, thanks. So what new powers will police have at their disposal?
Well, essentially, in the laws we're introducing today, it's the second tranche of empowering police to take on outlaw motorcycle gangs and disrupt and dismantle them. So the Attorney General already introduced anti-consorting legislation. Today we're introducing laws that will create firearms prohibition orders. And they will be very much focused on bikies and essentially prevent them from lawfully having weapons, but also enable police to search at any time for the presence of firearms.
Mm. And the penalties for gun crimes are also set to go up under the new legislation. What are the changes, and what sort of a deterrent do you think that will be for these criminals? Because they don't really seem to care much about the consequences of their actions, it seems.
Well, the first thing is to talk about these firearms prohibition orders, because they are really significant. It means the police can at any time, once someone's been served one of these firearms prohibition orders, they last for 10 years. It means that you can't lawfully have a firearm. So if you currently have a license and a firearm, you've got to surrender the firearms and you relinquish your license. If you breach that, you can be jailed for a term of up to 14 years or fined, or subject to fines of $75,000. But the laws will enable police to search an individual who's been served a firearm prohibition order at any time. So they can stop and search the individual, they can search their vehicle, they can search a residence, a place that they're located in. It also prevents the person who's received a firearm prohibition order from being in the company of anyone else who might have a firearm or a part of a firearm or ammunition, or in a location where they might encounter a firearm, so a firing range, or a shooting gallery, or even a paintball business.
Yeah, wow. And I think the interesting point there from what you said is in the same premises or where a firearm is being held, because previously the bikies, I guess, have found ways to get around the existing laws that technically could prohibit them from having a firearms license by getting family members to get a license on their behalf. That's going to be stamped out as well. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, that's been a problem. So people obviously seek others, perhaps people who are associated with their gang or a family member, and sometimes even juveniles. So these firearms prohibition orders can be served to juveniles as well for that reason.
Yeah, okay, wow. And so is this a result of police telling you, look, this is what we need?
Well, what happened earlier this year, I think everyone will remember, Chris Dawson, the commissioner, came out and said, he made the observation that when we were really tightly locked down last year for COVID, there was a massive reduction in traffic across the border. That enabled us to combine intelligence, the fact that police were meeting every single person that came across, every vehicle that came across the border, and some technology advances that enabled us to intercept some really big shipments of meth into the state. The meth basically comes from outside the state or outside the country. It comes from organised crime overseas like cartels, mafia, triads, but they don't have presence on the ground in WA. Their distribution technique, their muscle in the state, their way of getting it out there and selling it is the bikie gangs, the outlaw motorcycle gangs. So what Commissioner Dawson proposed was that we enable police to try and replicate what happened last year through a range of powers to break down the outlaw motorcycle gang's ability to operate and get what happened last year, which was a massive reduction in crime. Meth equals crime in Western Australia. Once you intercept the supply, you massively reduce crime and all the harm associated with the use of the meth.
Now, you've already highlighted that these new laws will be used to specifically target the outlaw motorcycle gangs. The police know who these characters are. They know where they are. So is it reasonable to assume that when this legislation is enacted, that the police have a hit list of people that they'll be targeting with these new prohibition orders?
I'm sure they'll use them to greatest effect and obviously target the most, probably in all likelihood, the most, or the ones that are likely to give them the most impact. So perhaps some of them are the high profile ones, but the ones that are doing the most harm through their leadership of these organisations, and then move out from there. That'll be a police operational decision. They will use the anti-consorting legislation as well, which enables them to give consorting anti-consorting notices to people so they won't be able to associate with each other. It stops them from wearing insignia or displaying insignia, and it enables them to give dispersal notices to groups of people who are travelling together in some of these runs that they do. So that'll be happening, and then they'll be getting these firearm prohibition orders, which will enable police to stop and search and conduct other searches of them and anyone with them to ensure that they're not, although to ensure that they are complying with the prohibition order.
Mm. And when do you expect these new laws will come into effect?
Well, I'll read this law into the lower house of parliament today. This is our last sitting week in the lower house this year, so it will go through the parliament early next year and we recommence sitting in February. The consorting legislation the Attorney General has already passed through the lower house should go through the upper house this year. There's another 3 weeks of the upper house sitting. There's no real reason for that to be delayed. We can only hope that the upper house passes it rapidly, and that could become law this year. And then we'll see early in the new year these two laws combining together to give increased powers to police to dismantle the bikie gangs.
Yeah, well, between the two laws, the anti-consorting and these new firearm prohibition orders, sends a pretty strong statement to bikies in WA. So what's your message to the minister?
The message is get out of the gang now or get out of Western Australia because you're not welcome here. We are bringing more laws as well. There'll be more powers for police next year in the first half of the year that we'll be introducing to enhance and support these ones as well.
Mm, fantastic to hear. I don't think you get many complaints from the people in the community. We'd love to see it stamped out. Police Minister Paul Papalia, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
Thanks, Ben.
You're listening to The West Live.
This week, Woodside got the green light to develop the biggest oil and gas project in Australia in a decade. And this morning, climate protesters chained their caravan to a concrete barrel, blocking the Burrup Peninsula, where the project is located, and causing traffic chaos for kilometres. Protests are reportedly a last-ditch attempt to stop the project after the Conservation Council launched a legal challenge. Relief teacher, mother and member of Scarborough Gas Action Plan, Petrina, is one of the three protesters on the scene, and she joins us now. Good morning, Petrina.
Hi, how are you going?
You're good. So tell us what you're doing right now.
So currently we are locked into a concrete barrel. Our arms are locked inside. There's no way we can get out. And the barrel has been placed on the road through the floor of the caravan to try to block the only road in and out to the Burrup Pub Peninsula in order to try and shut down operations of Scarborough Gas for as long as possible.
Yeah, right. So I'm just trying to get my head around what you're talking about here. So you've got a 44-gallon drum that's filled with concrete, is that correct? And then have you one arm in it?
My arm and Liz Burrows, my fellow activist, she is the other arm.
Yeah, right. And so are you able to remove your own arm?
No.
Okay. And so for the authorities, if that, I'm assuming they might try to move you at some point, what are their options?
Their options, well, if they try and move like the whole caravan off the road or move us with the barrel, then yeah, we're at serious risk of damage to our arms.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so the only safe way to get us off would be to cut us out.
So I'm assuming you're talking about the barrel, not your arm.
Yeah, the barrel. Yeah.
Okay, so it's quite extreme. And you're a teacher, you're a mum. Why is this so important to you?
Well, as a mother, I mean, this is the future of my children. I mean, I used to come up to this place. I remember as a kid we used to do family holidays up here and, you know, it was pristine. I come up now and I just cry at the sight of the, you know, the scars and the wounds and the land. But the point is this coast is not only a marine ecosystem. We've got a whale migratory path that Woodside want to dredge the ocean floor and sink hundreds of kilometres of pipeline known historically to leak. You look at any other massive gas projects from the seafloor elsewhere. And it's at the very edge of a marine wildlife park, so there's endangered dugongs, turtles, you know, countless species. In Australia, we've already wiped out thousands and thousands of species from, you know, centuries of ill-advised mining projects that don't take into account, you know, the effect on... And it's systemic, it's ecosystems. It's not just, you know, one species or one... area of land. It's, you know, it's all connected, and the the pollution from this is devastating. I mean, Karratha is already experiencing acid rain from the LNG plant, and which is affecting, you know, the ancient rock art, which is, we're talking, you know, 50,000 years anywhere else in the world. You know, if they found a gas seam under the pyramids, do you think the world would happily let them just blow up the pyramids or destroy Stonehenge or something? You know, this is just ancient culture. So not only for the people of this land, I mean, the devastating effects it has had on them, but just in terms of, you know, historical knowledge and ancient history, it's just horrific what they're doing up here.
Mm. And now this road in the Burrup Peninsula that you're currently blocking, who uses this road? I hear that the traffic is starting to build up a bit.
Yeah, it's banked up hugely, but it's mainly the workers for the Burrup hub. So you've got LNG, you've got Karratha Gas, and you've got Scarborough Gas, Pluto. So it's mainly... The road leads just to that operation. You can, there is actually, you know, you can go and view, there are tours for the rock art, you know, past here. And so if we've stopped any of those people, well, we would just say, you know, Woodside and this gas operation is destroying the rock art. People won't even be able to come and see it anymore. So, you know, really sorry for the inconvenience today. You know, and workers as well. We this isn't against them. This is a case of, you know, their jobs are not safe anyway. The rest of the world are divesting from fossil fuels. No one is going to be buying our filthy gas for much longer. So Woodside claim, you know, it's going to create all these jobs. They're going to be short-term jobs. If they cared about their workers, felt any kind of responsibility, they will be looking for, you know, other ways to source energy and taking their workers with them, you know, retraining. So we apologise to the workers. This isn't about them. This is about the corporations and the governments who, you know, are in each other's pockets. The, you know, Woodside and the BHP and the Chevrons, they donate hundreds of thousands of dollars to both major parties. They don't care who gets in because it's just business as usual, you know, and Labor and Liberal, they take that money. And then they listen to, you know, it's the lobbyists that have all the money. They have the senators and the ministers' ears. And people without money trying to protect country, this is all we have. You know, this is the only way to get our voices heard and out there.
Now, Petrina, I hear the police have been on the scene this morning. What have they said to you?
Well, we try not to talk to the police, so we've got police liaisons, other people to talk to them, just because, you know, it makes it easier with regards to repercussions and, you know, legal stuff. So with us, they've been pretty pleasant, actually. They've just come, checked we're okay, asked if we needed water. Other than that, they've basically just been doing traffic management.
Mm. Yeah, well, so far, so good as far as the protest goes. Relief teacher, mother and member of the Scarborough Gas Action Plan, Petrina, good luck up there. Hopefully you stay safe and
you're
making your message. Thanks for joining us on the West Live.
Thanks very much. All right, see you. Stop Scarborough Gas!
Now, the date for FIFO workers to get their first jab is just a week away, and some of WA's mining giants have already started making moves. So what's the plan for the Rios, the FMGs and the BHPs of the world? The West's mining reporter Stuart McKinnon has some of the answers, and he joins me now. G'day, Stu.
G'day, Ben. How are you going?
Good, thanks. So before we get into what the individual companies are doing, I'm curious to know, like, in your opinion, how many workers do you reckon are currently unvaccinated?
Yeah, look, that's the $64 million question, really, Ben. No one really knows, to be honest, how many are vaxxed, how many are unvaxxed, how many are sort of on the, you know, still deciding whether to get the vax. We probably will only know the final figure come December 1. I suspect there's probably a lot of people out there who are just holding on to the last minute to get their first jab, and they're hoping something happens in the intervening period where they don't have to. But look, some industry sources say it could be as high as 5%, and that's just a figure sort of that they're, I guess, plucking out of air based on the you know, the wider population. So obviously the FIFO component is just a representative of the wider population. So yeah, could be as high as 5%, but we won't know until December 1.
Yeah, right. 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but I bet if you're talking to mining companies who are already stretched at finding workers, 5% would be pretty horrible. But then there's not a one size fits all approach from the industry when it comes to this. So what can you tell us about how different mining companies are approaching it?
Well, some mining companies, some resources companies have already stopped flying workers to site who aren't vaxxed, so they're trying to get ahead of the game, so to speak, while other companies are sort of waiting till the day, and anyone who's unvaxxed come November 30 will be flown off the site, off sites. So, yeah, different companies are handling it in different ways.
Yeah, wow. So, well, actually, on the day, on December 1, say, all right, everybody who isn't vaccinated, you're getting on a plane, you're heading back to Perth.
Basically, yeah. That's what I've been informed from BHP. That's the plan with BHP and Fortescue Metals Group.
Yeah, right. And so at that point, would those workers be dismissed, or would they be suspended? Or, like, I guess, what happens to those workers at that point?
Look, that's another very good question. And companies have been reluctant to tell me, you know, exactly what will happen to these workers. But based on the experience in New South Wales, BHP introduced a mandate for workers in New South Wales to be vaxxed by the middle of this month. What BHP did with those workers who weren't vaxxed is basically stood them down without pay. I think there was about 50 or 60 workers involved there. So, look, if that was the policy over there, I assume BHP will adopt a similar policy over here, and it'll be a case of being stood down without pay. Now, as far as the other companies go, they've been a bit more circumspect about what they're going to do with their staff. There is some suggestions from the union that, you know, employees should be allowed to take any accrued leave before they are dismissed. They're calling for, you know, they're saying termination should be a last resort. Some people might be needing more time to make a decision. So, you know, if people can use up their accrued leave while they make a decision, that could be an option for some workers if companies are flexible enough to agree to that.
Yeah, they've only had 18 months of a pandemic that has killed 5 million people to make up a decision. But now, last week, Mineral Resources boss Chris Ellison came out and said that, you know, they were so desperate for workers that they'd take hairdressers, bankers, waitresses, whoever it was, they would train them up, give them a job. And he also said when it came to mandatory vaccination that they're not in the business of making people redundant. But he didn't know what he would do with workers who refuse the jab. Do you think that's kind of, that reflects where the industry is at to some degree?
Look, I'm sure to termination will be a last resort. You know, companies don't want to lose workers, not at this moment in time. There's a shortage, as you've noted. So, look, they'll be doing everything they can to get people over the line. But at the end of the day, and every company has said this, we can't have people on site who are unvaccinated or haven't had their first jab by December 1. So this is a law, you know, they can't break the law. So they're committed to that, but they're also committed to giving their employees every opportunity to get that first jab and helping them over the line as much as possible.
Mm. And now we've talked about, I guess, what some of the penalties are for workers who don't get vaccinated. Chevron revealed it had raised more than $120,000 for charity through an initiative where they were donating $100 for each fully vaccinated worker to one of four charities of the workers' choice. Are there other companies that are providing incentives as opposed to just a bit of stick? Is there some carrots being thrown around?
Yeah, look, I believe BHP have some sort of reward system as well. They didn't expand on exactly what that is, but they did refer to sort of an incentive scheme. I don't think it's particularly lucrative for people to get the jab, but it is, you know, there's something there in terms of an incentive. You know, again, I think companies will be using every sort of, I guess, weapon at their disposal to get people over the line because they don't want to be losing workers at this time.
Yeah, and we're talking about the potential for losing workers, even if it's, you know, the worst case scenario might be 5%, but even if it's a 1% or 2%, what sort of an impact do you think that would have on the industry?
Yeah, well, as I said, you know, no one wants to lose workers at the moment. I'm sure that companies have made arrangements, you know, for imminent loss of workers as a result of this. You know, they wouldn't want to be caught on the hop where, you know, essential operations are put in jeopardy. So I'm sure they've made arrangements, have contingencies in place to deal with it. But, yeah, well, we'll just have to wait and see what happens on December 1, I suppose.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting. A week from now, next Wednesday, The West mining reporter Stuart McKinnon, thanks as always for being on The West Live and sharing your insights.
No worries. Thanks, Ben.
You're listening to The West Live.
Leavers Week, where WA students flock to various hotspots to celebrate finishing Year 12, is coming to a close. And as we hear a collective sigh of relief from parents across the state, it may be a good time to talk about sexual health, what teenagers think about STIs, relationships, and where some of the blind spots might be. CEO of the WAAC, formerly the WA AIDS Council, Lisa Dobrin, has been on the ground for Leavers, and she joins us now on The West Live. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Ben. Thanks for having me today.
And so what are young people telling you down there?
Okay, so young people are talking to us about wanting to learn and having more frank and open discussions in safe and non-judgmental environments about sex, alcohol and substance use.
Yeah, right, because they're probably topics that some parents prefer to keep swept under the carpet, but you're hearing that young people actually want open and frank discussions around these issues.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Young people don't really ever receive practical sex and relation education at school. So they're wanting to know strategies on, you know, how to be able to engage with the other young people, subjects such as consent, safer sex practices. They also want to talk more about how to drink and take drugs more safely and how to look after their mates if they're in an environment where they haven't maybe spoken to someone else about taking drugs or alcohol before or about having sex before, and they want to know how to do that in a safe, harm-free way.
Well, I think the issue of consent is a fascinating one to discuss because there was the federal government campaign that involved drinking milkshakes that I don't think anybody really understood. I don't think it made it through to young people. So I guess what are their concerns around the issue of consent?
So, Ben, young people want to talk about normalising sexual behaviour, and we need to, as a society, have greater opportunities to have a more robust and mature conversation about what sex is and what sex isn't, and about being sex positive, and part of that is about talking about consent. So young people don't understand necessarily what consent is and what it isn't, and advertising like the milkshake campaign didn't particularly help that. We understood what the government were trying to achieve, but they probably missed the mark. So young people want to know what consent is, what it isn't, and what does it mean when you've maybe had a few drinks? What if it is maybe when wine, you've mixed some drinks with some drugs, and then how do you behave in a way that's that is consensual and that is appropriate and that is safe for both people involved?
Mm. And we know that amongst adults there is a real issue around consent and what constitutes it after alcohol consumption. How much of a difference is there between what young girls look at consent and the way young boys frame it in their minds?
Well, all young people need to have better education and safer spaces to talk about sex generally and what sex is and what it isn't for them, how they feel about it, how they feel about other issues such as sexually transmitted infections. Do they know about what they are and how to prevent or put in measures to make themselves safer around that area? So do they know about condom use? Do they know about the use of lube? Do they understand that you need to have a conversation with someone at all points of a sexual experience about whether checking in with each other around, are you okay about moving to this level or not? The biggest issue we have as a society is the taboo around talking about sex generally. So we're down here in Leavers. We're talking about the lengths of waiting times to get your ticket to get your into Leavers. We're not talking about things like how do you feel about having sex with your partner, how do you feel about having sex with someone else, and how do we keep you safe in that environment. We're not talking about the fact that young people are using drugs and alcohol, and the police do an amazing job as to the rest of the Leavers response down here in Leavers, and our job as a collective is to keep young people safe. But why are we not having the conversation on the news and in the media about the fact that young people will have sex and how to minimise the harm if they're going to have sex and give them better education and safer spaces to have these conversations about these things that we're all doing but we think that young people shouldn't?
Yeah, I can tell you why we're not having those conversations. I think the parents are a lot like that river in Egypt, you know. There's a bit of denial going on here. And you mentioned STIs. What are the trends that you're noticing at the moment as far as those sexually transmitted infections go among young people?
So generally speaking, not speaking predominantly about what's happening in Leavers, because I can't comment on that too much at the moment because we're not sure what's actually happening down here in terms of that. But certainly in Perth, you know, there is a syphilis outbreak. It is real. It is problematic, and we need to do everything we can. Again, it's about education and about having safe spaces and conversations around the fact that syphilis is a thing. People think of syphilis as something that happened hundreds of years ago, and people like kings and queens and Al Capone died of syphilis. The reality is it's a sexually transmitted infection. It's very much on the rise, and it will be with us in WA and wider Australia for a very long time. So we need to educate young people about what is syphilis and what do we do about it. So again, we're down here giving out tens of thousands of condoms, we're giving out lube, we're talking to people about how to protect yourself or have safer sex. So again, first it's acknowledging that young people are going to have sex. It's then speaking to them about really practical ways of keeping themselves safer. So first is consent, then we're talking about condom use, and then we're talking about, again, if you're going to have sex with someone, how to do that in a more safer environment. And if you don't know what to do, then have a chat with someone who you feel safe with. The other thing then is around prevention and testing, so regular STI testing, going to your GP or going to a sexual health clinic or coming to us and asking for some support, phoning helpline, things like that, just practical stuff around how do I keep myself safe if I think that I may have been with someone that may have transmitted an STI, then what do I need to do about that?
Mm. And so what's your advice for parents? It's probably too late now because their kids are already at Leavers, but when they come back, what sort of conversations should they be having with their children?
Great question. So again, it's about normalising sexual behaviour. It's about the fact that we all have sex. Sex is a really positive thing. Sex feels really, really good when it's consensual and when it's in an environment that is safe. And when you're experimenting, particularly as a young person, you want to be able to try things out with someone that you feel safe with. And we should be normalising that. Again, it's about education and it's about harm minimisation. So checking that your young people have condoms, checking that they have things like lube and that the right lube with the right condom is going to work effectively, making sure that they understand that the things, the images, and let's be honest, the education information that they're getting is through generally porn or through, you know, conversation. It's not often the kind of sex that, you know, not everyone wants their child to be having, but the reality is that's where they're learning from. So we know this. So let's normalise this. Let's take away the taboo. Let's not pretend that by telling young people that fear-mongering and telling them they shouldn't be doing it are strategies that work. Let's talk to them about harm minimisation. And that includes, I just want to make a comment on as well about alcohol and drug use. The reality is that there has been a change recently around with border restrictions, and COVID has done a great job around keeping a lot of illicit substances out of WA, and we're really grateful for that. But conversely, the other side of that is that there's poorer quality drugs around. They are of a higher price, and young people, as a result of not being able to access the substances they often will use, are now using other substances. So we're seeing things like drugs of choice still are alcohol and MDMA, or kind of ecstasy is what it's known as, and but other young people are using things like dexamphetamine, which are things like ADHD medication, as well as caffeine tablets and other things. So again, it's all about harm minimisation. Have the conversation with your young person about what it is that they're doing, what they want to experiment with, why they want to do it, and helping them to create a safer environment to, one, talk about it, and two, if they're going to engage in those experiences, to do that in a more safe, harm-reducing way.
Pretty good advice. CEO of the WAAC, Lisa Dobrin, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
Thanks so much, Ben. Have a great day.
The Wild West.
Joining me now in the studio to host The Wild West is my super producer, Kate Ryan.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well.
It's weird to say hello to you because we've been already working today for a few hours. But look, let's just jump straight in here. So in today's edition of The West Australian, there's a publication that I think a lot of people look forward to each year. It's Jordan, our wine writer's annual list of the top 100 whites, sparklings and rosés.
I am very happy to jump straight into that this morning. Under $15.
Okay, hang on. So he does, you know, the best wines, expensive wines. But you want to focus on
under $15.
I think
journalist wages.
I think that speaks volumes for how classy we are. but I guess a lot of people would think you couldn't buy a decent bottle of wine for under $15.
No, I mean, I buy wine under $15, and then sometimes
Does it often come in boxes?
Not anymore. I've graduated to bottles.
And so what has Ray found out? Has he got some good ones for us?
There are a few. So right now I'm just looking at the whites. Under $15 looks like Amelia Park.
Oh, yeah. Great WA winery.
Semillon. I was really surprised to see Horton Classic White.
Really? I thought that was something your nana drank.
Yeah. I mean, it's been around for a while. It's very Kath and Kim. But apparently 91 out of 100. So,
wow.
Yeah, maybe they're getting better. Pinot Grigio, Yolumba Y Series. That's only $15.
Yolumba, I thought they only served that on planes. You know, it's like you get the little
you pay a full bottle price for. But mine is rosé.
That's your jam?
Yeah, that's my jam.
Can you buy a decent rosé for under $15? Surely not.
No, okay. So this is where we're venturing past the $15 here. I think you maybe can get some good wine, maybe just about the $20 mark rosé.
Yeah, that's to me, that's what I think is probably the limit to a good rosé. I think there's like an organic rosé that you can get from BWS. It's called See No Evil, I think. Sometimes you can get it for about $18. That's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a $18 one here, La Vieille Ferme.
Oh, yeah, nice pronunciation. It's French.
It is French. $18, 92 out of 100.
Oh,
yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, but I mean, after a couple,
I find? We're really getting into some open and frank discussions about our alcohol consumption here. But I like to go to the bottle shop and maybe get a couple of bottles, right? So, like, say if it's going to be a night where I know I'm going to have a few drinks, very responsibly, of course. And so maybe instead of buying two of the same rosé, I'll buy two different ones to just try a few different things, right?
So do your own kind of blind taste.
Yeah, I do my own blind. Oh, it's definitely blind by the end of it. But it's, but the, But the problem I always find is like I'll have one. I'll go, oh, wow, this is great. This is wonderful. And then that bottle will be finished and move on to the second one. And it'll be so different in style that it's just like, oh, I don't.
Yeah, the first one you're like.
And so no. I don't do that anymore. Now I just buy two of the same, which I think I probably always should have been doing. If you're going to drink more than one bottle in a session, which, I don't know, is wine supposed to be sessionable?
What is a session? Is it just over the night?
Who knows? And this is the difference, I think, between us regular people and Ray, our wine writer. Like he had to try 750 wines to compile his list of the top 100. Yes. So he's just having a little sniff, a little sip. He's probably spitting it out into a bucket.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, he'd be legless. But
and the ones at the 700, you're at the 700 mark and they're like, fantastic. Yeah, this is great. Yeah, exactly. Love it.
Exactly.
150 out of 100. My
reviews, if I did the top 100, it would be based on, you know, after you hadn't just had a little sip of it, it'd be okay. You've had a bottle and a half. Do you still like it?
Yeah. I think that is a good indicator as well, because you get the really buttery Chardonnays and things like that, and they're good for a couple of sips, and then you're a glass in and you're like,
yeah, a bit overpowering. Yep, yeah. I'm with you. And I find the same with sparkling, right, which Ray has cast his eye over a bunch of sparklings, champagnes and Prosecco, which is very interesting as well. And that's one you find, like, you go to events, right, and you have like a, you know, maybe a sparkling to start off with, and then you go, do you know what? I'm going to have a couple more of those.
Yeah.
And then eventually it gets a kind of a, I don't know what the technical term is, but I want to say like cat's pissy kind of quality.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? So I think sometimes finding a sparkling that you can kind of like drink deep into the evening is a challenge, especially an affordable one, because French champagne is pretty expensive.
It is expensive. Yeah, I mean, I don't really make a habit of going out and just drinking sparkling.
Yeah.
I feel like it's very fancy.
That's why I do it. I even have those. I even have at home, I even have the champagne glasses that are like the really wide ones, like a Great Gatsby.
Oh, yeah.
Do you make those towers of glasses that you pour the thing in?
Do you do that at home? Just like
I only have four of them, so it's a pretty crappy tower. But I do. Like I have a sip out of it, and I do feel very Gatsby-ish.
Yeah.
So classy.
That is interesting.
That's us. That's pretty classy.
Yeah.
So that's in the paper today. People can pick it up. And at the opposite end of the class spectrum, Mandurah.
Good segue.
And hello to all our listeners down there in Mandurah. Don't worry, Rockingham's way worse. You're okay.
Yeah. Armidale's off the hook now.
Exactly. I've mended my bridges with the good people of Armidale. Mandurah's next. And their aquatic centre has caused some problems.
Yeah, it has. So there's a leaking roof. And, I mean, that's not very good coming up to summer and Christmas. Also, a leaking roof, if it's going straight into a pool.
Would you even notice?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like if...
If it like a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it fall, did it actually fall? If a leaking roof leaks into a swimming pool, did it even happen?
Yeah, it's just free water.
extra water. So are the locals up in arms about this?
They are a little bit. I mean, it looks like this leaking roof is causing a bit of issue that the whole pool is going to have to kind of shut down. And it's going to take 16 months and $2.5 million
You know, I'm doing some roof repairs on my house at the moment because of the storm that happened earlier this year that damaged a lot of roofs. I tell you, I can't find a tradie for love or money. So I'm not at all surprised that it's going to take 16 months to fix this leaky aquatic centre in Mandurah. But how much money did you say it was going to cost?
$2.5 million.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know. I mean, what part of the roof is it? I'm looking at a photo of it now. Doesn't look like a massive building. It's not like they're going to have to go one end of Mandurah to the other. It's not that big.
Yeah, wow.
So, I don't... It's been like that way since 2016.
Probably if they'd initially fixed it back in 2016, it probably would have cost like $10,000 to fix.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And it's part of the original roof structure, so they might have to do a little bit more.
Yeah, construction work. Oh, well, spending $2.5 million is eye-watering to you. Imagine how much money NASA is blowing when they crash a satellite into an asteroid.
I love this. As a space nerd, I absolutely love that they're doing this, but it's going to cost millions.
It'd be billions.
Actually, $333 US million, so $457 million Australian.
But that's how much it costs. And so, and why are they doing it?
So it looks like they're doing it as more of an exercise. They're launching a satellite to kind of crash into an asteroid. The asteroid isn't threatening Earth at all, and it won't, even if they...
So just going about its business, flying through the cosmos.
And they're just like... Let's get you.
and so is it? Is because in my imagination, they're doing it as a sort of a test to see if there is an asteroid heading towards Earth, if they can use a satellite to divert it. Is that what's going
it's
on
pretty
here?
Pretty much to see if it does work. Do it on something.
So it's Armageddon, basically Armageddon with Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck.
Exactly, without
and
the
Liv Tyler.
Options.
and without Bruce Willis. Or do we know that he's not on the satellite?
Maybe.
How do we know?
Maybe they do it because it's by SpaceX, isn't it? I mean, NASA and SpaceX.
So Elon Musk.
Yeah.
So
powered by Falcon 9 rocket made by SpaceX.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. So
I get worried. There's a part of me that gets worried about this sort of stuff because I think, you know, like things that are just minding their own business in space, my policy is kind of just leave them alone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What if you nudge it and then it just goes into orbit and then...
Exactly. Because I think about, like, in any job that you have down here on Earth, you know, people make mistakes, right? People make mistakes in their jobs all the time. And is a rocket scientist immune to making a mistake? Has some mathematician who's calculated the path of this asteroid got it 100% right?
Mm. Oh, yeah. No, I don't want to think about that.
do we know when this is going to happen? When we will find out if it's a success?
It's still a while away. I think. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen like tomorrow.
Here's but something else. What happens if there's some kind of creature living in this asteroid? They release it.
Yeah. Or they make it angry.
Us.
They're
See, this is this what I'm talking about. It's like exactly the same as in the old Superman movies. There were those guys like General Zog. the look on your face is priceless. I might as well be talking Mandarin to you right now. I'm not even going to go into any more because I'm just thinking about the plot of how they were imprisoned in this kind of like a pane of glass that was flying through space. It will not make any sense to you, but it was a thing that happened in the 80s. Take my word for it.
Yeah. It's like,
get a box of wine, sit on the couch, and watch Christopher Reeve as Superman, who you probably don't even know who that is. So anyway, let's move on. So now the Royals are a regular talking point on this show, and now we know about the feud between the royal family and Meghan and Harry, but now there's a new feud between Wills and Kate and the BBC.
Yeah, and I'm here for it. It's about a documentary that they made, and it kind of insinuates that Wills may have been briefed on the feud with Harry and Meghan, and they've said it's completely unfounded, the claims Harry, Wills and Kate have. So usually every year there's like the Christmas Carol concert that's filmed on or broadcast on the BBC, and they've gone, well, if you're going to release this documentary, we're just not going to let you show the Christmas carols and you'll lose all those billions of viewers.
Oh, wow. So they've actually cracked it.
They cracked it
at the BBC. And from my reading of this story, they've not only said to the BBC, nah, too bad, we're pulling the pin, you're not going to be getting the access to the Christmas carol. They're going to be giving it to one of the BBC's rival networks.
Their biggest rivals, ITV. And apparently they are delighted.
Yeah, well, you would be, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And so is ITV, I'm assuming then, would be a commercial broadcaster?
I think it is.
So it could be worth a fortune to them.
Yeah, and all that advertising as well.
Yeah, wow.
For them.
Oh, well, there you go. So, yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. The royal family and the British tabloids and the British media is an interesting relationship because it's sort of a symbiotic relationship. They sort of need each other.
They do need each other, but then sometimes one goes too far and then the other don't go too far, or they do go too far. It's very, one will exist without the other. I feel like the royals will just be there, but they just won't be very popular.
Very relevant. I know. It's interesting.
They could walk on the street and no one would know
who they are. It's one of the don't bite the hand that feeds you, but it's I can't work out who's feeding who in this relationship. It's very codependent, I think. Well, Kate
very
Ryan,
toxic.
Thanks for joining us today in the Wild West. Well, I'll see you tomorrow. I don't know if I'll chat to you. We'll wait and see.
Thanks, man.
Well, that's it from me. Glad to have your company. I'll be back tomorrow live from 8:45 a.m. You can download the full show or individual interviews by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
Mm.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on the west.com.au to deliver.